Welcome back to the Financial Coconut Podcast Network, the leading personal finance podcast network in Singapore. I'm your host, Reggie, aka Your Chief Financial Coconut, and every Thursday, you will finally get to chill with us. Hosted by Andrew, we will be bringing on some of the quirkiest, geekiest, leading voices in the personal finance space to give them ample time to talk about their stories, the lessons they have learned over time, and some good advice for all of us. What has aged well? What didn't do so well? Why did they do what they do? So sit back and chill with TFC.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Not religion, you know, like I'm sure like within like the financial community, if something new comes up, there's going to be people who are like, this is good, this is bad, this is how I think we should do it, this is how everything is like that.
Absolutely. So... How Muslim are you?
That's why. Hey, Coconuts, I'm your host, Reggie, aka Your Chief Financial Coconut, and welcome back to our Islamic Finance Special. So exciting. I've been wanting to do this for a long, long time for the community members that are of the Muslim faith. But for all of you tuning in, actually, non-Muslims can also invest in Sharia investments. Did you know? Our expert today, Mr. Raja Muhammad, aka Raj from Five Pillars, who is one of the leading experts on Islamic banking and finance in Singapore, has some really interesting thoughts. To him, investing in Sharia compliant investments is just about having good morals and not about the religion itself. But to make sure I don't get cancelled, and to make sure these questions that we're going to put forth today matters to the community, I've invited a great friend of mine, Taisha Khan. Actress Taisha Khan, you may have seen her on Channel 5 or Surya, but to me, she's still the crazy girl that I hang out with in JC. Specifically for today's episode, there may be some technical terms that if you want to get the most and the best experience out of today's episode, you should check out part 1 of this series, which is a primer on Islam financial terms. So without further ado, welcome back to Chills with TFC. Okay, so
ta-da!
Welcome back to another episode of Chills, and today you have me in the house, Reggie, aka Your Chief Financial Coconut, because today Andrew is very occupied. So I am on set together with a childhood friend of mine, quite childhood already, lah. Huh? Like teenage friend of mine.
Because which camera to look at?
I think you look at that one, like camera, white camera. Right. So because we're gonna talk a little. Oh, yeah, talk. Look at that camera. Okay. So because we are gonna talk about a topic that is, I don't know if I can talk about it. Right. I don't know if I should participate in the conversation, but. Yeah, I can, you know, but that's why I brought a friend on, and her name is Taisha. You want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Taisha. I'm an actor and a writer. You may have seen me on Surya. You may have seen me on Channel 5. You may have seen my poetry. As long as you've seen me.
I didn't even know you write poetry.
Published.
And together we will be hosting Raj on set with us today, Islamic finance expert. But would you like to introduce yourself a little bit more?
Yes. Yeah, well, hello, my name is Raj Muhammad, and I've been in this industry for close to since 2005, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's been a while, and then I registered a company to offer this professionally since 2008. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to give my take on how Islamic finance can actually benefit not just the Muslims, actually the investor community at large. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my take. I want to double down on it. My take. Why is it? Why must you clarify that is your take on Islamic finance?
Well, because what happened is this: Islamic finance, as especially in the age of social media, you know, everyone is an expert, right? And everyone's going to give their point of view. And then sometimes the ignorant who is not aware may find contradictory conflicting and sometimes even confusing information. So that's why it's very important that we kind of qualify how why we say it, and hopefully we want evidence and try and validate what we say with, you know, with data or actual scriptures and etc.
And also no one person can, like, he says it's his take because, like, you know, that's how he practices it. Mm. It can't be like one person represents the entire human population of Muslims, ma.
Yeah.
I'm very afraid I get cancelled. It's like, why am I going to say?
You know, actually, she's right. Mm-hmm. So just getting of them. So let's just ignore Christianity. You look at how polarized the take on that is, and including Hinduism and etc. Yeah. So I guess whenever when it comes to a touchy subject or a sensitive subject, like a religion, you will have differentiating views and opinions.
And even if it's not religion, you know, like I'm sure like within like the financial community, if something new comes up, there's going to be people who are like, this is good, this is bad, this is how I think we should do it, this is how everything is like that.
Absolutely.
So... how Muslim are you?
Anyway, for all you tuning in, you know, don't cancel me. You know, I'm really coming from that like super ignorant.
Cancel him. He's been around for too long. Need some competition. I want to take over.
Oh my goodness. But yeah, I think for context sake, right? Like, how do you identify, you know, in the... I don't know, is that like a Muslim spectrum? Like I don't know.
Yes, the rainbow, green color, purple.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, lah. I think with any religion, whether be it like Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, everybody has their own way of practicing. There is, of course, the main rules. We have what we are supposed to follow. But even within Muslims, there are those who follow what you're supposed to follow and those who don't. But still identify as Muslims. So I think personally, I would say I'm quite Muslim, but also I feel like I'm somewhere in the middle. I don't know a lot. And part of Islam is always the quest to keep learning more and understanding more and like finding knowledge. So I will say that I don't know everything. In fact, I would say I barely know. I can't say that either. I know lah, but I don't know everything. I don't know a lot lah, okay? So, but I do try to practice.
Then why you here?
Because you asked me to be here. What's this question? I thought you needed we are on a
quest together here today, right? Yeah, we're on a quest together here to learn, right? And I think to kick off the discussion, right? I think there are a few interesting pointers that we can go into, but let's start with the basic of like what is Islamic finance, right? Like, I mean, I think I wanted to do today's episode to achieve two things, right? One, to allow non-Muslims to get a rounder view of like how the Muslim population, our friends think, and at the same time empower, you know, our Muslim community within, which is a subset of our community, right? And there are a lot of Muslim listeners, you know, in the podcast space, and I really want to connect and reach out to them also, right? So what is the take on Islamic finance? What is it really?
Fantastic. If you were to ask anyone who is an Islamic finance or investment proponent, you know, the answer that you typically will get is, oh, we cannot indulge in, you know, interest-based transactions. We cannot participate in sin industry, which is obviously the adult entertainment, casino, the alcohol, and etc. And then you cannot go into the gambling chances. So as such, a lot of financial instruments are maybe deemed as non-Islamic. However, I am not a supporter of that kind of a definition, because someone who wants to know about Islamic finance, the body language is we want to subscribe. There's an interest. So that's why you ask, what is it? And then we as proponents of this Islamic finance should actually embrace it with both arms. Mm. So if we were to give a negative, no, you can't do this five times. I mean, if we just say we can't do this, that
kind of to five
definitions, okay. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you ask, what is it? And if I throw you 10 no's, then that is not proper, we believe. So we have now summed it up in a very simple way. And anything that's deemed harmful or non-beneficial to yourself as a human being, to the community and the environment, can be deemed as non-Islamic.
Ah, interesting. Right? That's a lot broader than the religion itself.
because it's that simple too, right? So if you were to try and find all the no's that typically you get from, and you will find that they all gravitate towards the negativity towards an individual, community, or harmful to the community. So if you take interest-based transactions, and people ask why, the original tax is against usurious practices. Now, what is usurious practices? And I say simply try missing your credit card for a day, and you'll be slapped with a $100 bill. So now I asked you, regardless of what your faith is, do you agree to pay a $100 fine for missing one day? And you'd show me one individual who will say, I'm so happy to pay. You will never find that. To us, such practices are usurious, right? The excessive charging money on money.
Is it usurious in terms of the user or in terms of the person giving the money? In this case, a bank who's giving you the credit card.
No. The usurious means you're charging. So it's usury. Usury. So those practices, so the bank is now harming you by slapping you excessive charge for you missing a day. Charges, penalty and charges are acceptable in Islamic because they are deterrent. Because you have a contractual obligation to fulfill something and you're obliged. And to have a charge is to tell you if you do, that there's a penalty. But to charge you excessively, that's what we are against.
Honestly. So is there halal credit card? Sorry. Actually, I'm so horrible at this.
I'm going to defer because I don't know the answer to this.
Yeah, it's just like the language.
Absolutely. Like I said, we are again usurious practices. Credit card is not. So credit card allows you to manage your finances carefully, right? So you are able to pay, but you would be paying later. And if it helps you in your finances, why not? However, taking the same credit card, be it halal or non-halal, and then
thank you for coming to my level. It's like halal or non-halal. You know, like,
I mean,
is it okay? Wait, is it okay first?
Like, what do you think is wrong with saying that?
I don't know. I feel like you know, like Islamic. You know, there's like this very like there's a zone. You know, so I think
on the good side of things, at least you're erring on the side of caution and trying to be respectful, which I think is nice. I mean, halal and non-halal. Finance, definitely. It applies to finance as well, not just food.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So regardless of what card you have, and then if you were to go and abuse it, and how do I abuse it? Because you could use the halal credit card to gamble too, right? I mean, who's stopping it? So the halal credit card can be also be subscribed by a non-Muslim, right? Because it's not only for Muslims per se. So having said that, so there is a avenue for people to abuse the cards, regardless of whether it's issued by an Islamic institution or otherwise. So what we are against is, as I said earlier, is a usurious practices. If you were to go and check the database on regularly, just at Google it, you will find billions of dollars have been paid for financial misbehavior. And all of them have been conventional banks. So you don't get penalized if you are proper, only when you misbehave. So conventional banks have in some way have misbehaved, and that's why they have been penalized, and something running into hundreds of billions of dollars. So there are issues in the practices and some of the instruments that conventional banks gives, which Islamic institution would not support.
What are some of these reasons that causes the fine and all these kind of penalties?
So if you look at the reasons, they have been quite interesting. For example, there is this concept called proprietary trading. So what does proprietary trading is? Typically, banks have been asked to manage customers' funds, right? But over the years, when there were so many opportunities to make money, banks have realized that they should invest their own funds to also make money, right? So if there is a high net worth individual who has given millions of dollars to the bank, and in the event the bank invests and makes so much money for the customer, they've realized, why should we make just for him? Why can't the bank too? So when the bank goes into that element of so-called proprietary trading, and then sometimes we have found banks and they have been penalized, they do this so-called front running. So what is front running? Basically, when you trade, you will find that you have an opportunity to buy low and sell high, and you make the spread. And sometimes there are privileged information as to why there will be a movement in the price. So banks sometimes get this information, use it first, And then they benefit it, and then they sometimes give some of it to the customer. So this is called front running. So this is one thing. And then there are many other misbehaviors that's happened. Something as they have not managed their customers properly, or they have malpractices to artificially inflate the bank's profits or share price. So if you look up, for example, there's this famous bank, Wells Fargo. If you look it up in the United States, you know, they have been questioned by the Congress and etc. So there has been numerous occasions where the banks have misbehaved, sometimes helping the clients to tax evasion, and all this kind of misappropriateness has been what brought the banks to pay these huge fines.
And that's un-Islamic.
Absolutely. It's not only un-Islamic, I think any, even a non-Muslim would find that unethical.
Yes.
So if you were a customer of a bank, and if you find A, that the bank made money first before you did, is you will not accept it, even if it's Islamic or un-Islamic. Mm-hmm. And then if you find that your accounts have been misappropriated or has been abused, you would not agree with it. You know, if people find that they have started issuing you cards that you did not apply, all right? They've started opening accounts that you did not apply. So these kind of things are the ones that I think not only Muslim, anyone would not. So these are things I am not guaranteeing the Islamic banks won't do.
Yeah, that was my question. It's like, are you certain that the Islamic banks won't?
They absolutely. Yeah. Because it's human errors we're talking about, right? Mm. While the principles tell you not to, right, there's still people crossing the line. So there may be instances. Yeah, human beings. So we are prone to. So anyone who abuses and who does not comply to what they should do would be abused too. However, having said that, since there, see, conventional finance has been around, it's been cited like some 400 to 450 years old, if you look at the practices. Islamic finance, although they rely on scriptures worth 1,400 years ago, they have been only been a serious contender in the same space over the last 3 to 4 decades. Okay, so if you start looking up the introduction of Islamic institutions, you'll find that it has been in very recent times. So we are looking at 400-year-old practices and trying to compare it with something that's in a very nascent stage, right? So there will be missteps in Islamic finance too, but there has been a lot of misbehaviors and misappropriateness and misconducts on the conventional side as of now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I have a question to ask. So prior to this 30 to 40 years, what kind of forms did Islamic finance take? I mean, since, you know, it's been around since the dawn of Islam. Like, sure. There were businessmen and businesswomen and banks and all that.
Absolutely. So let's look at it. When does anyone need financial advice? You don't need it always. When you have just started.
Always need financial
advice. This is different kind, right? Different kind at different level, yes.
No. Financial services versus advice is two different things,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So everyone needs financial service because they are not saving or putting the money under the pillow anymore. Correct? So we need to put the money in the bank. Mm-hmm. So we started off with so-called something as simple as savings account or current account to manage our money. So that is financial services, right? The ATM and etc. Somebody needs financial advice when their disposable income increases. So I have enough to eat, do my daily chores and social services, etc. Now I have got 10,000 more. What do I do? That's when it started increasing. And it gets more sophisticated as that amount or that part gets larger, right? So that's where we are. So prior to the advent of serious Islamic or big Islamic finance institutions, Islamic finance has been practiced in much smaller scale within the community, right? So obviously it started off in the Middle East. And then...
Why is it obviously?
Well, because that's where Islam started, right? So when Islam started, the whole of the Muslim world looks towards our Prophet and Mecca and the advent of the Quran for answers. Mm. So obviously that's where it started, right? So the practices of the prophet's time, how did him and his companions dealt with certain instances? So that's where it started. So it started off obviously in the Middle East. And then as trades gets bigger and better, so first there were cross-cities trades and then cross-country trades, and then you find cross-continent, etc. So as you get more sophisticated, you find that there is a huge movement of capital that was happening too, right? So Malaysia started to say, hey, you know what? Since we have a large number of Muslims, let us now try and introduce Islamic finance. And then your next question could be, wait, Indonesia is the largest Muslim country. Why did Malaysia? You probably could do that. I think there were different issues and priorities in the different countries at different point of times. And that's why Malaysia was at a point of time that they could very reasonably kind of like develop the Islamic finance market. Mm. And Indonesia could have other structural and infrastructural issues that they may not be able to introduce it as fast or better than the Malaysians then.
I live in Malaysia. I live in Subang for all you guys tuning in. So my assumption is everything is halal. Even the banking service. You don't even need to like question, like this is confirmed halal. Yeah. Like, is it compliant? But is that the reality?
Well, not necessarily, because I think Malaysia's first Islamic institution was the so-called Tabung Haji. And Tabung Haji is merely a savings arrangement for the Malaysian Muslims to save up for their pilgrimage, right? So when they started saving from young, so that they can go
do
to
this
pilgrimage.
In a documentary, man. It's like so interesting.
So much to know.
Yeah, so much to know. Please. Yeah. Yes.
So they want, because doing a pilgrimage was a costly affair, and since it's only once in a lifetime, I last heard in Singapore it was close to 18,000 or so.
What?
That now. So then,
really? Yeah. No, I had the opinion that it was like more animal.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I've heard exorbitant amounts too.
Yeah.
But having said that, so because it was quite a pricey affair, Malaysian Muslims started saving young. So to go for a pilgrimage 10 years down the road, they started saving today. And obviously, having a majority Muslims in Malaysia, that became quite a powerful institution. And then Malaysia, the next institution they introduced was Bank Islam in Malaysia. So these were primarily for domestic consumption. They were not international banks, neither were they regional. So they had enough masses to support both the institution and the services. So that's how it started. And then came the financial crisis. I think it's a 9/11. I think yesterday or day before we celebrated the, I don't know how many years
celebrated.
Was that? Oh, well, kind of commemorate.
Like, don't cancel Raj,
please,
okay?
Don't relax.
We didn't
mean it that way.
Apologies. That's very bad. Coming from a Muslim.
Yes.
So the commemorate, the world commemorated the 9/11. So that's when they found that the liquidity, so that was one reason. And the second reason was when there was an exorbitant oil price increase sometime 2008 or 7 or whatever, there was a four-fold oil price increase, and they realized that the money in the conventional market has disappeared, and then the Middle Easterns became super rich overnight. So when those who needed the capital went over to the Middle East to raise funds, they started asking, are you Sharia compliant or are you Islamic?
Yeah, there was a period of time I hear people going to the Middle East.
So when they went
there.
Exactly.
Yes.
So they wanted to go over to start raising capital. And then these were the Citis and the Standards and the Chase banks of the, you know, that caliber, these big banks. So when they started asking, remember I told you we have 450 years experience? They started offering, structuring halal or Islamic products. Mm. So Standard now has an Islamic bank equivalent. I forgot the name, Sadat or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. HSBC has got an Islamic bank equivalent. Yeah. And then equally Citibank has Citi Islamic and etc. So all of them started offering. These international banks of that caliber and that size has both the capital and reach to market Islamic finance globally. And that's when people started taking seriously, and that's how you saw them spreading. So to answer the question, it started off in although it is realized in the 1400 years ago, scriptures, etc., it was more of a need and want and necessity, and that's how it grew.
Clarification, can our Islam listeners, can our Muslim listeners be certain that you know, some of these big banks that they have like an Islamic finance division or like a separate entity that the money will be managed separately between the different entities, and like this whole vertical is compliant.
You see, it's a very interesting question because let's just go to the core of it. What are you really trying to do or achieve? So there's two sides to it. Me as wanting to ensure that my investment remains halal, right? That's one of my concerns. Now, what the religion tells basically is it actually asks you to make enough query, enough to understand how halal are they. A very simple example is if you go and eat at McDonald's, I simply look at the green sign. I don't look at, I don't go to the kitchen to see them actually slaughtering chicken. Is it halal or not?
You can't go down the whole production line and try to find out, like, this is chicken really from, like, was it raised properly and all that?
Or look at the halal sign in their meat or whatever.
So you don't have to essentially do that. Trusting you have the agency, to, right?
Exactly,
or the governance body.
Yeah. Well, not really governance body. You see, it's you have all the choice to place your funds or invest or have a relationship with this institution or not. No one else compelling you to. Mm-hmm. So you could walk to CIMB Islamic or Maybank Islamic, and then you would have made your due diligence to make that decision. And your due diligence is looking at the literature, and to get anything that comforts you, it is. So you would go to Maybank and then look at Islamic, and then you say, who is pronouncing it as Islamic? So you see that there's a certificate and you're happy with the people who signed off. There it goes. That's all that's required.
Mm. And I wanted to say that part of the religion is also to have good faith in other people, be they Muslim or not. So, I mean, if, like, you trust that if someone is saying, or a certifying board of people is saying something is halal, then you should have faith in it.
Mm-hmm. And I think banking sector is very regulated, right? So I'm assuming Islamic banking sector is very regulated also in that way.
And I think, you know, even in Singapore, so if you have have a relationship with the bank and they are deemed otherwise for some reason, you can bring it up to the court of law and get judgment. So you could say misrepresentation when you are not and you're assured you are, and you can actually sue them.
So is there Islamic finance in Singapore? I mean, I see some of these branches, but I just want to know, like, because from what I hear in Malaysia, for all the Malaysian listeners, it's Islamic first. Right? Is it like everything is core?
No, it's not. What has happened in Malaysia is there are more Islamic banking services and products
than conventional ones.
No.
So there's a lot more.
Yeah, zero to now maybe 100, and it's growing.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Because more institutions are offering.
Yes. But then what about in Singapore?
So in Singapore, what has happened is, you see, there are four ways where financial institution can offer Islamic products to Muslim consumers. And the four ways are maybe five. So the first one is what they call as a window. So you walk into a bank like OCBC, for example, if there are 30 counters, then you can find one of them designated as Islamic. So what happens then is that is usually just to test and say, there are two reasons for they are doing it. First, they want to say that we are also in this space. Secondly, to test and see if there are enough consumers to go and to expand it.
Yeah.
So if they find that the queues on that particular counter is getting louder and more, bigger, then they know, hey, we have a market, right?
Don't chocho all the machi go there and queue up, right?
Don't surprise them. Machi, their bank is on the arms.
Okay.
Christmas tree.
Maybe now they want to invest. You never know.
Yeah, you never know.
Right? So the first one is a window. Mm. So the next one, if they find that there are a lot of subscribers enough, then they may now go from window to what we call as a branch. So if Maybank has got it, so if they have got, I think, 22 or 23 branch, they've designated the one in Geylang as an Islamic branch.
Nice.
Right? So that's something. So what they want to do, they just say, this branch product gives more product. And so if you realize from a window, it is a counter to a branch. The next level they would go into is called the subsidiaries model. So subsidiary models will now take on bigger services such as giving corporate services, you know, issuing bonds and more money market products and etc. So the first one counter is primarily savings accounts and etc. And then branch may give, you know, a bit of home loan or fixed deposit and etc. And then the subsidiary will now be, so this is the one you just mentioned, right? The Sadiq and etc. So this whole subsidiary, so which means the capital, the seed capital would have been given by the conventional bank, and now it's wholly on, so it's run, all the activities will be done so in
at the subsidiary level.
At subsidiary level.
Okay.
Right? So in the group level, they would report that, hey, our subsidiary making this much profits and etc.
Okay.
All right. And then the other method is what we call as a full-fledged Islamic from day one. Islamic bank is one example. No subsidy, no nothing. It's fully an Islamic bank from day one. All right. And then there's another method which is called by transactions. So somebody would walk into a bank like DBS and say, hey, I want to issue bonds, but can you make it an Islamic bond? So if you realize there's no counter, no branch, no subsidy, no nothing, but you'll make sure that this particular transaction from this customer, because the fees are quite handsome, then they say they would now make it an Islamic issue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So these are the several ways they are doing it. And in Singapore, I think we have got CIMB and Maybank. And then quite a number of insurance companies are also offering Islamic funds, right? Which Muslims could go into.
Yeah, and I want to push you on the fees being handsome, right? Because these days, everyone talk about low cost, right? Okay. Like fees must be low so that you maximize your returns.
Yep, yep.
So I want to get a bit of color on like what are the fees around these funds. And,
okay.
You know, is it really worth it? You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You see, basically, let's look at why would anyone want to get into this business, right? Why would anybody want to offer an Islamic rather than a conventional? So there must be some value system or some motivation for them to go this way versus the other. However, understand that now, let's just take an example. If somebody wants to open an Islamic bank, if they were to offer a lending rate lower than the conventional, I think that's not tenable because they all are benchmarked to the, what would I say, either the common money market rates. You know, they used to call it LIBOR or something along that. So it's always benchmarked. So it doesn't make sense to say the Islamic banks are going to charge you less you got to pay less interest or anything of that sort.
I think more the retail crowd, they're more concerned. Is it going to be more expensive? You know, so that I can invest in Islamic funds or Islamic compliant products. Yeah. Am I going to be paying more?
The answer is no, you will neither be paying more or less. They would always be adjusted to stay relevant and to... You see, these institutions have a responsibility for their shareholders.
Yeah.
Right? Just because it's Islamic doesn't mean my profitability should be compromised.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they would always adjust the rates according to the market rate at the then prevailing rate. But the incentive is somebody who feels, you know, there is a moral obligation for me to go to Islamic versus conventional. I mean, let's look at a very simple dilemma. What happened for some reason? There is a bank that's offering lesser lending rate or charging you lesser lending rate, and Islamic is charging you more, and you happen to be a Muslim.
I'm sure a lot of people are concerned about
that. So the question then is that because it is your personal decision. It's your decision. So by going to a conventional, there is no law in Singapore that's going to penalize you. Right? So we have left it as say that you are answerable to your creator and a story. So if you say that no, regardless of what is it, I'm very strict with my principles and my this one, I will go to Islamic, fine, because you're not getting incentivized here. You'd be answerable to your creator, and then that's how the consequences would be met. So the answer is that you will not go to an Islamic bank and guaranteed a lower rate, borrowing rate, neither you will be getting a higher profit rate, and vice versa.
If Islamic banking becomes more widespread in Singapore, do I have an Islamic obligation to go to the Islamic bank if they are both on like equal footing, like they have the same interest rates?
I think you will sleep well and feel comfortable if you go to Islamic. Because again, like I said, there's really nobody telling you not to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So religion is a very personal transaction between you and the creator. If somebody understands that very well, I think everything falls into place. I can go out and drink alcohol today. Nobody can stop me. And I would not, because we have got our principles and etc. And then if I am crossing the line, if I'm sinning, I'm answerable. I got to face the consequences. So in the same way, what we are offering in Islamic finance are some of the things which are very in parallel to what we call ethical, right? So what would we do? Well, if you place your funds with us, you can be guaranteed, or at least we can tell you in principle, that the funds would not be going into developing arms where there's wars. We will not be putting the money into child labor, you know, those kind of things, right? It is something that is any human being would want to, it resonates, right? Mm. So if people understand that part, I think that's perfect. I think nobody has the rights, or nobody can compel you to do something that you don't want to. Because end of the day, let's look at it. Assuming as a Muslim, you have decided to grow your wealth with a conventional bank because Islamic bank doesn't pay enough. Now you're going to be getting more. You decide what you're going to do with that more, right? Because in Islam, what we call it is the word amana. You see, it comes to saying that we owe nothing. We are trustees of God's resources, be they natural, be they the financial, right? Including our children. They're all our resources. And how do you deal with them?
Including your children?
Yeah, because how are you going to, you have responsibility, how you bring them up.
Okay.
So if you don't bring them up well, then if they are going to go out there and do harm to others, that you are responsible. That's why the word amana comes in.
Okay. Like your children have been trusted to you. And they've been given to you. They are trusted to you. Yeah. So to do well by them.
Interesting. I want to then ask, you know, because this, I keep feeling like you're saying that, you know, not, you don't need to be a Muslim to use Islamic financial services, right? Like, so how does that work? You know, what is the take-up rate and like, you know, how are things kind of moving there?
I'll answer this a little bit. I can't answer this. But I mean, you are not Muslim. Yeah, do you enjoy nasi padang?
Love it.
Exactly. Mm. You can enjoy, it's like halal food, right?
Yeah.
So why can't you enjoy halal finance?
Excellent. Thank you.
Fair point.
Thanks.
Great. Woohoo! Yes.
But coming back to financials, yes. let me give you an incident that happened a few years ago. There was a conference that I participated, and then we had one of the big four sitting in there. And they reported that the subscription rate in the early Islamic products by the non-Muslims were higher in Malaysia than the Muslims. And naturally, when you make such a statement, you know, you tend to ask, why is that so? How come there are more Muslims liking this thing, right? And the answer that individual gave was they saw transparency and accountability as an interesting feature in the Islamic finance.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
And then I raised the hand and I asked, shouldn't every institution be?
Sorry, I should have been laughing.
Enjoy that, eh?
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah.
We got, you can't see when he's sweating.
Well, we are like in this space, you know, so I know. Yes, please continue.
Yeah, I mean, you know, truly, right? Why should only Islamic be accountable for their activities and how they have managed it? And why should they only be transparent? Shouldn't everyone should be?
Can you give me a bit of color, like, how is it transparent? Like, what is it different, you know, and all that?
Well, I don't know, because what happens is there are certain standards in reporting in every country and they can differ. So I don't exactly know what he meant by that, transparency, but he kind of cited these two. So if you look at for example, the local standards, right? Every listed company have got to have a certain accounting standards that they need to abide by, which may differ from their mother company if they are located elsewhere, right? So what happened is, I think he said that Islamic finance may need to go and be rather specific about the investments. So they cannot give generic, perhaps they got to declare more details into where the money has gone into, and then how they are dealing with the income if they happen to come from non-Sharia activities.
Interesting.
And who is checking on that?
Oh, okay. Very good. You've realized that every listed company has to give an audited report public. So, number one, the financial obligations and financial reporting are checked by the auditors, and most of the time they are chartered, maybe the Big Four. And then the Islamic parts are ticked off by the internal Sharia panel of scholars who knows
fancy, to deal in it. Interesting, and I mean, it's a fair point because I think and there are a lot of funds that don't tell you exactly, you know, they'll show you like top 10 holdings, top 30 holdings. Even you read deeper, they will tell you proprietary, we cannot tell you exactly what's your composite and all that.
Let me take you up on that point because that's very good. Now, just because it's not reported doesn't mean you're not entitled to. Mm. So you as an investor can ask questions beyond that. So you could actually ask, if you find that their prospectus are lacking information, even if you are investing a next to nothing amount, right? Let's say you're not putting in $1 million, even if you're putting $5,000, an investor has the rights to ask that question, and it is my obligation to respond. So if I were to come in and say, hi, please tell me who is signing off your this one as Islamic, and can you give me their qualification? Mm. It is the duty of that financial research to give it to you.
And
if they refuse, you can report. You can report to MAS because, all right? However, I as a financial institution may now give you a generic thank you, but we are not interested to take you as investor answer too. I could.
That's also a fair point.
But then, you know, that's like not any loss on your part because you did your due diligence.
So you've got to be realist. Mm. But the question, let's just always go to the core, right? We are not here to make a trouble, right? We're not here to create anything. It's just for your safety of mind, and you need to be comforted. Nice. So please know that just because things that are supposed to be reported aren't reported doesn't mean you don't have the right to know more.
Great. Interesting. Is there, last question for today. Is there any particular misunderstanding about Islamic finance that you want to bring out to specifically to our Muslim listeners?
When I was doing Islamic finance, I had an interesting request from a Japanese potential financial institution. They came in and said that, hey, could we offer this in Japan, but don't use the word Islamic? And then I asked them why. And then they say that to a common Japanese investors, the media is inundated with too many negatives, right? Islamic terrorism, and those kind of things. So it's difficult to cross that bridge, right? So that's number. We said, so a rose by any other name, right? So we would want to promote, and we really hope that, you know, first of all, you know, we want Muslims to try and demonstrate and accentuate the wonderful features that Islamic finance has to offer, right? Number one, and Muslim and non-Muslims to look at it from an ethical investment point of view, right? Islamic finance is not the silver bullet for all the financial problems. Let us understand that we are not. We are still learning. We are still wanting to know how to deal with the sophisticated products that are coming into the market, and we are catching up, honestly. Right? So it is not a silver bullet, but I can guarantee you that if people would have looked at Islamic finance seriously, we would not have had so much financial crisis as we have had today.
Bam!
Bam!
Stay tuned all the way after this quick note for our personal money question segment. Before that, I hope you've learned something useful today. Join our Telegram group, follow us on our socials, and check out thefinancialcoconut.com.
Okay, first question. What has been your best and worst investment you've ever made? Doesn't have to be financial.
I think coming into Islamic finance, I'm an accidental Islamic finance, a professional, right? It's accidental because I was working in conventional bank most part of my career and also in other financial data, like a company called Bloomberg. Because I happened to be the senior most Muslim professional there, my supervisor gave me that task. And that's when I realized there's a huge opportunity. I think coming out to do this thing on my own could have been my best investment, because I think advising and being in this business has a ripple effect, and I'm glad that I'm able to propagate the salient features of Islamic finance through my services.
And the worst investment you've ever made?
Oh, goodness gracious, what did I say? I put a bit of money on some cryptocurrencies. I think it didn't do well. So I would have not done that if I had, on hindsight.
Okay, so the next thing is, what's one thing under $100 that has been a game changer?
I think I bought myself a nice suit from New York in an outlet. Under 100, yes. Ooh. Brooks Brothers, mind you.
Why is it a game changer?
Oh, no, because it kind of looked good, you know. I went to conferences in them and it kind of like, you know, I tend to look younger than my age, so that kind of like make me more professional.
Oh, and gave you superpowers.
Yes, it sure did. That it sure did, yeah.
One place that you can learn from that you think is underrated can be a book, a website, anywhere, anything.
I don't know, but I find the, and I'm not promoting this site, the articles and features from this Atlantic, I think, publisher is something I thoroughly enjoy and love. And it's wide spectrum of subjects and very well written. I think that's something I go to quite often and it's on my safe list.